Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
It's true.
And Justin Robert Young.
Yo, what up?
I'm going to just do a quick plug at the top because I forgot to do this, and it's a free plug. Anybody out there who's listening who wants a copy of my book, How to Make Money on Mars, I will send it to you. Just hit me up at andrew@andrewmain.com, and I will send you a link. You just tell me if you're on Kindle or you are on regular EPUB, whatever. You should sign up for my mailing list. I send out free copies there, but sometimes people are like, I didn't know you gave it away. I'm like, I sent out like 8,000 emails telling people. But anyhow, I want you, if you listen to the show, I want you to have it for free. That's just my plug. That's it. So, guys.
Yeah.
There has been some interesting sort of talk about virtual reality platforms. Microsoft is going to be unveiling their new VR system that is lower processor intensive than like Oculus or the Vive. And I think we all can kind of agree. And like, there's some company that came out like, hey, we fit the whole processor thing on a backpack. Isn't that great? And we all can kind of go like, that's going to be hilarious a year or two from now. We're like, yeah, remember when like you had to plug your VR system into a computer and have a cable, you know, we all know that's where it is, but the fun to be had right now, there's a lot of fun to be had. So it's not to be like that's stupid, but we know kind of like, I think we all agree the real future is going to be when it's just the standalone sort of thing, right? With me?
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
I had a little, it was an Andrew epiphany to everybody else. Was kind of obvious or whatever. But one of the things is that, and I think one of the problems we've had with VR right now and getting people on board is that things like Google Gear, it's kind of neat. These other things are kind of cool. And Oculus is sort of cool. But until you do it with room sensing and it senses and it relates how your actual body moves, it is a different experience. It's not real, what we would say real VR. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Yeah.
You guys back me up. Like once you did Vive, what was the experience?
Oh my God. It was the difference between night and day. And keep in mind, I was generally positive on Google Cardboard. Like the first time I experienced that, I was like, oh wow, it really does. I can't believe this is just my phone. I'm looking down, up, left, mm-hmm. right, and I'm in another place. But that was nothing compared to the leap when you're able to walk around physical objects in the actual space.
Yeah, and to people who haven't tried to make it, it's not just a matter of like, hey, I'm moving around. It's you if you just nod your head and you move your head 3 inches to the side, everything shifts. And I was trying to explain the difference, like before you guys did Vive, I'm like, it's, you know, Oculus, you know, without sensing where you are, or Gear, it's like you're laying on the edge of a pool and sticking your head underwater and you're looking into it. The room sensing or sensing where you are, location aware, is you're really in the world. You're moving around and it works. And there's not a lot of research on this. And it was one of the things would be great discussion for our friend Paul Zach, because he's got this great data showing how if we're holding on to your cell phone and looking at video, you're much more emotionally connected to it than if you're watching it on a big screen because it moves with you. It is neurologically, it is a much more immersive connection when the same little shifts and stuff that you make translate into that world, and it convinces you that it's real and it not just that you've got a monitor strapped to your face. So, you know, I think we agree that like in a year or so, as that technology becomes, it fits it into the one device you put on your head, it will change. It will really become the big sea change in VR, and people will be like, oh, I get it. And we'll be like, yeah, I had an epiphany. Cause I know we've talked about esports and we've talked about that sort of stuff. And you know, we had the discussion with the Olympics, would we ever see esports on the Olympics? And I would say no, more is just because of the way the Olympics work. But the idea that could esports become bigger than regular sports? And the thing that made me think about this was games like Overwatch and games like other stuff like that. If I am virtually there as a participant watching it, if I am virtually there watching it or whatever, I think, yeah. I think it becomes a totally different kind of thing where if we're standing down on a building watching these battles take place and we have that same level of immersive that people playing it kind of have, I am a big, big believer that that's going to happen. And now, Justin, go ahead, lead off where you're talking about right before.
So, yeah, Blizzard announced at BlizzCon this week that they are going to be going forward in the next year with the Overwatch League. This is going to be significant in that the publishers of games have always had a varying degrees of interaction between their esports, a blooming, right? And Brian, you probably have a little bit more of a – and Bryce, feel free to correct me because I'm not super – into a lot of this, kind of world. But the way that I understand it now is that the biggest money that you have in esports are in tournaments, wherein, sure, you have teams, but it is essentially like kind of golf, right? Like everybody gets together, they play a thing, and then at the end of it, they go off. So it's like tennis and golf in that it is very kind of singular. What Blizzard wants to do by taking control of this a lot more is to sell franchises to people. So people would be investing their own money in buying franchises like you would buy a franchise from the NFL. And then you would have regions where you'd be able to hold your own hold your own home games. You'd be able to have your own fans. You'd be able to sell – you'd own the rights to the franchise to sell advertising on it, and they would have a pathway for trades and a pathway for a salary cap. So effectively, you create the same level of drama that you have in a persisting a league like the NFL or the NBA, but now with esports, which it really fascinated me because it was taking – it's kind of making that leap from the golf or tennis, which is that idea of let's just hold these tournaments at its best. At its worst would be, let's say, boxing, right, where you can see where corruption and stuff, builds, into a lesser product. And taking
allegations, allegations of corruption, Justin.
Sure, allegations of corruption. And now it takes it into a world where you have this kind of persistent thing, where now it's like, oh, wait, like – now I got a reason, even if I'm kind of casually into the idea, like my wife's really into Overwatch, the idea that they could have a San Francisco team or an Oakland team, and we could just go see that team play. And it could be an event, a smaller event that isn't, this other gigantic thing.
I'm really surprised. To keep in mind, I'm seeing all of this for the first time, but it sounds like a core bill a core component of this is regional ownership or regional team basing. I got it. That doesn't strike me like the way the internet works, because it seems like we're much more tribal. It seems like a Diamond Club team would attract all of the Diamond Club fans in a way that an Austin team would not attract all of Austin.
All right, let me throw this out there, though, Brian, is that I don't know if they're excluding the idea, but like if you look at where you get some of your highest concentrations of overlays of people who play this and all that, start thinking about college campuses and stuff. Mm-hmm. You think about the UT or MIT or places like that, the USC team or places that are kind of around there.
Which Blizzard has had experience with the Heroes of the Dorm thing, right?
Yep.
Like, so they had college-based teams play each other in another game, Heroes of the Storm, that was broadcast on ESPN.
And by doing it regional, is if you want to do events, live events, to have people show up to go to a movie theater, rent out one of these movie theaters that does digital projection and stuff and say, we're going to have it there, it makes it much more easy to put people there and to actually have people location-based to do it.
Yes, it definitely does. I guess... In a world where there's so little friction to take money from millions of people, just 99 cents at a time to participate in whatever this tournament is, it surprises me to have the difficulties that come with geographically located, tournaments and face-offs and all that stuff, running physical events in places.
Well, and T2 brought up, the idea of the ping times, things like that, that is one of the problems you've had in sort of like big league plays or stuff before, is that it can affect international play. It can make a difference between, going when you've got to transmit, the back and forth considerably.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, there's also, I think, part of the idea that like Blizzard has seen esports kind of evolve on so many different levels, right? Really, like StarCraft is kind of the canonical, you know, big boom, big bang of esports, right? And they've seen it evolve, you know, into Heroes of Storm, Overwatch, Hearthstone, yada yada yada. In listening to interviews with pro Hearthstone players, they are facing real economic decisions to say, well, you know, really a lot of the big money tournaments are in Europe, but I can either go out there and live in Europe for a month and try to run three or four of these tournaments, hope that I land in a certain level of time or of how good I am. But really that is being eaten away at, like, well, I could just stay home and stream on Twitch and I can make my money that way, just connecting to fans directly. And I think when I look at this, the problem that Overwatch wants to solve is, hey, we're going to run this season from this time to this time. If you get signed to a team, then like any player who gets signed to a pro league, either, in from the minor leagues on up, it's going to pay you enough that you can regionally live there for X amount of time. And,
yeah.
And this is just your job. And now it's exciting. Now you create, I guess what excited me about it was that now there's just a predictable place where stars can be made on a level that the tournament structure just can't do, because tournaments are so boom bust.
Yeah. Well, Brian, there's nothing saying that you can't, and maybe it's time we actually formally announce that you are going to house the Diamond Club Overwatch team in your house as you cultivate the young talent and you do this.
You know what? I'm on board. I can't imagine Bonnie will have anything negative to say about it. I think that we're looking at her schedule. It's wide open. Let's get everybody in. Let's make this happen.
I am super excited, though, that the idea that, like, you know, there are a lot of people out here that have done really well on Twitch and they've done really well on YouTube and everything, that now all of a sudden the idea of them becoming owners in a league, like, and elevating themselves, like, it has this weird, like, ABA kind of vibe to it, where it's like, really, how far is, like, Terpster or Yogscast or something like that, or Kind of Funny Games out here in San Francisco, how far are they from buying a team? And now all of a sudden they're team owners and they're promoting games and stuff like that.
Oh my God. Like, why did you just infect that thought in my brain? Like, the idea of what a brilliant notion. Just as the MP3 made possible the middle class rock star, and that live streaming made possible the middle class Jimmy Fallon lifestyle, now we have the middle class Mark Cuban experience of being able to afford to put together your own sports team.
All I'm saying is that you are one lunch with Richard Garriott away from being a minority owner in an Overwatch League team.
Man, that would be a lot of fun. That would be a lot of fun. Wow. Wow.
This would be this management. You wouldn't be playing Overwatch.
Oh, no, I know. Oh, I know. I mean, that's why it would be fun, is because to play, you'd have to be listening to folks like me shaking his fist like, what are you doing? Are you taking Adderall? You need to take more Adderall. Get focused. Come on.
What? And that it's funny.
Oh, you got a girlfriend. So you seem to be able to have two priorities in your life right now. That's great. No, go ahead and do that. Ruin everything I put together.
That's right.
For your own personal life.
There are dozens of dollars out there waiting to get picked up. You think I paid this to have you waste my time? Get out of here.
The other thing is that what Brian and I were talking at the last Nerdtacular with somebody who probably shouldn't be named that works at Blizzard, right? And we were just talking about Hearthstone esports specifically, but esports, I think, in general, and the star problem with esports, which is, like, when I say that there's a star problem, it's not that there aren't people that have tremendous name recognition, because they were all there in Irvine last week or over the weekend, and I'm sure they were mobbed and they were treated like literal Christ. But you have a hard time breaking out of the hardcore audience because, in general, esports players are not the most charismatic people on the planet.
Well, right? And also, like, on your character sheet, if you want to be great at esports, you would spend exactly 0 points on charisma. Like, that is what makes a good esports player. Whereas separately, and if I'm picking up where you're headed, Justin, this whole scheme builds in a managerial type role, a face to the game, somebody who can be there, who can inject the very real drama that sports fans crave that makes for good television.
Well, it brings esports to the promotion world, right? And that's what tournaments never really have, because the best selling point of a tournament is we have all the top talent. They're going to play the game. Somebody's going to win. And now you better hope that the guys you like make it to the end, or that the person who's coming from out of nowhere to win is interesting and has an exciting story. But anybody who's spent any time watching a lot of esports knows that there is just that weird, cringeworthy sort of interview problem where ultimately a lot of these guys are getting far more media polished now than they were, you know, 5-10 years ago. But there still is just a little bit of that personality gap. If you are in a promotional world, then now what's the Al Davis of esports? Who's the Mark Cuban? Who's the probably Mark Cuban, but who's the Jerry Jones of these teams? That now it's like, no, there's a reason to build narrative, to build promotion, to build rivalry, to build, you know, now there's little ideas of like, okay, well, this player's underperforming. And meanwhile, there's somebody else in the league that could really use that person. Now there's sellers and buyers at the trade deadline. There's just a million little conventions that I think esports is ready for it, and it's ready for esports. And it's made me excited about it. And I have played maybe 3 games of Overwatch in my entire life.
Let me throw out some questions here, though. So. And I think the league is a way to get around the star problem, because the problem, it's like, you know, I used to go through this where people talk, you know, like the skeptics, like, why can't we make scientists into like rock stars or the fame of actors? I'm like, well, one is you're not doing something that's relevant that people really understand what they're doing. Two is rock stars and actors are famous because they're good looking, you know, and they're charismatic. Yeah. You know, like name me famous people that don't have either, you know, the charisma or that, or just inherently interesting. Name me some sort of genre. Like, there's a reason why, you know, you could pass your favorite writer on the street and never realize it was them. You know, there's a reason that, you know, it's frustrating when you read reviews of movies and they talk about the directors and they never mention the writers. They never mention the most uncharismatic aspect of these sorts of things. And I think that's,
yeah.
It certainly is an approach towards, like, as you said, like, you know, listen, it's like, I don't, you know, if I find out that, you know, like, remember, like, Gene Simmons was like into sponsoring, I forget what, like Arena Football or like, yeah. Kiss Arena Football.
Bon Jovi had a major stake in Arena Football.
I believe does. I believe Bon Jovi owns the New Jersey Arena Football League team.
Yeah. So you could see that was a, you know, I had friends that did like Arena Football, and, you know, they're, you know, working the bar at, you know, Outback Steakhouse at night or whatever, you know, it's sort of, but you go like, oh, okay. Like, if you build that team and you build that, and Justin, you touched upon the idea of like companies sponsoring stuff. Like, here in LA, it's like, I think of like the number of tech companies in here between, I'm going to say the name SpaceX, you know, that are huge gamers, you know,
yeah.
That, you know, I got JPL over here in Pasadena and stuff, and I could see that, you know, somebody doing leagues there. But when you start talking about moving it to a pro level, that's a whole nother game too.
I think it seemed like a very interesting play for Blizzard. Now, all that being said, just because it's interesting and it seems like a really good idea, there is a very amazing graveyard of people who have had very interesting ideas to start sports leagues that have died horrifyingly expensive deaths.
Sure, so, but I gotta tell you, this is a very iterative approach, and it's borrowing. It appeals to the right things. It's from a company who arguably is number one in the world for the esports game. I don't know. I think it's a smart way to do it.
I agree. And you know, there's just a really great You know, it's a great product. I mean, like, for Overwatch, you know, this is a game that's putting out these like Pixar level little short movies, like building a narrative universe around their characters, and they're fantastic. They're great. So now the idea is like, okay, well, here's another hook of accessibility. People can just really like the characters, that the characters are well designed and they seem to have a story. But now let me introduce you to this next level of this person who's playing in a game and, you know, has a crazy, his crazy chat handle on the back of his jersey, which is also very, XFL-y, which I enjoy.
Dude, no, I love everything about this. Hey guys,
and T2T2 is saying that this is copying the LCS format, but which I am not familiar with. So listen, this might just be totally a ripoff of another idea. I just like it.
Agreed. Hey, you know what I like and is my pick is for us to support certain Patreon for your friends of mine. Patreon.com/ Auntie Donna, AUNTYDONNA, are our friends, and they're very, very funny. They're supreme beings of comedy, and they just launched their Patreon, 20 minutes ago?
I believe 21 minutes ago. No, it was over the weekend. I mean, can we harass them to do this?
Yeah, no, we sort of said they're dumb if they don't do it, and then they did it. Now it's like, well, crap. Now I feel like we have to make sure it's a success.
Like, yeah, or else we're gonna be real dicks.
Yeah, dude, I definitely I'm looking at their page right now, and it says here, their first post says, "Woo, first post, LOL." Responded by Jury Facts, who says biggity bang, and a bunch of our folks there in the chat. It's good to see them represent.
I think that they're great, and I would highly recommend it. I have become a patron, and I'm looking forward to my money creating more fun Auntie Donna stuff.
Yeah.
My pick. You want to know what? Speaking of the excitement about the Overwatch League. Let me see if I can get the name right. I believe it's These Boys Have All the Fun. It is a book about the 1990s. Or no. Oh, maybe it's Boys Will Be Boys.
These guys have all the fun inside the world.
No, that's the ESPN one.
Oh.
Another different author. Anyway, it's about the Dallas Cowboys teams of the 1990s. Written by Jeff Perlman. The glory days and party nights of the Dallas Cowboys dynasty. I'm just looking forward to the book that gets written of the esports version of it. Like if you want, like, that's what star power is. Star power is 20 years after these teams have stopped playing, people are interested about hearing the stories of what happened behind the scenes. And that's when you can break out of just who won and who lost and how many points there were and whether or not somebody did their job on the field and get into, no, wait, I'm curious about their lives. I'm curious about whether or not they were handling success well. I'm curious to know whether or not I want to think that this person's a good person or a bad person in life and not just on the field or at their application. Like, that is what star power is. And that's what I'm excited about the Overwatch thing. And this book is a great example of people who were very, very, very interesting.
For the record, that's Boys Will Be Boys is what it's
that's
called.
That's it, yeah.
My pick. I want you to imagine every night when you lay down, put your head on the pillow, one of the greatest storytellers of all time knocks on the window, slides it open, climbs inside, lays down next to you and tells you a story. Now, I know that's creepy.
Yeah.
But he's a really good storyteller.
It's getting a little bit Shrek is love, Shrek is life.
You know, and if you just said, listen, just tell me an hour a night and then go back out the window and just leave me. Imagine if they could do this for 50 nights. 50 nights, right?
Uh-huh.
Every night, one of the greatest storytellers in the world taps your window, climbs through, lays down next to you and tells you a story. Now, the way you can have the story told to you is if you've got a I'm going to mute an Amazon Alexa, you know, you could do that. Either of you, you guys have dots too, right?
No.
I've got the Echo Dot is also great. Do you have an Alexa?
I do.
Yeah. Dots are great. Keep it on your desk, whatever kind of thing. They're only like $50 right now. Highly, highly recommended. If you don't want to go put all the money into an Amazon Alexa, the Dot's great. Does all the same things. Doesn't have the same degree of like room, you know, microphone sensing and the volume, but it's still really, really good for audiobooks alone. Audiobooks alone, just the ability to listen to an audiobook, you know, anytime you want with it just saying, play my book and have it start playing your audiobook where it left off the last time is amazing. Okay. It's one of those things, like I would say that the killer app for me and the Alexa has been audiobooks, for other people it's been Lower Lights. But anyhow, back to what I'm talking about. I have been listening to and thoroughly enjoying, it's on Audible, you can get it for one credit, you can get 50 hours of this, The Collected Stories of Arthur C. Clarke.
Oh my gosh. Oh, that sounds awesome.
So it is, it's like, I think almost all of his short stories. And the problem is like, you kind of don't know what's next. So I had to go find a list of them and what the lengths of them are. And Arthur C. Clarke's, and that was, you know, we think of just kind of 2001, but this is a guy that really was, he made his name really, I think his short stories were what built up his name and who he was. And
it's 51 hours, 9 minutes long.
Yep.
Totally buying it right now. With my last credit.
Brian, you're going to be very happy you did. They've got two different narrators who go in and do them. It is the stories are sequential. So it starts through, you know, Arthur C. Clarke, kind of like his whole, the publishing history of these stories. So I'm in 1949 right now, or roughly sequential like that. I'm kind of like where that is. Of where the stories are. And there's just been some amazing ones in there. And you realize like some of the really best ideas we've already had, you know, we talked about the whole idea of what if aliens, you know, CRTV, he did a story in like 1949 or whatever it was about, you know, aliens coming to Earth and trying to find out what happened to us and finding, you know, getting this historical record. And I won't spoil what it was, but when you hear the line, you go, it's fun. You know, it's just that kind of thing where really, really, really cool stuff of just stories, different ones. And I think they're really good quality. Like some, you listen to a lot of like collected works of a lot of people. And like, I think this only got published because of who they are. The first story there, Travel by Wire, he wrote this in 1937. It's about teleportation, a wonderful 1937 teleportation story. Just great. So that's my pick.
That is awesome. I just bought it just now credit.
Where are we getting this again?
Audible.com.
Enjoy it there. And also, like one of the things, just a little tip, is that there's a lot of really, you can get a lot of stuff if you have an Audible subscription, or if you want, like on Amazon, sometimes look for a lot of the classic books and classic works. You can buy the Kindle version for 99 cents and then odd the Audible narration for like $2 or $3 or something.
Yeah, so,
like,
brilliant.
I just did listen to, like, you know, I spent like 20 hours listening to Jules Verne, Mysterious Island. It wasn't that mysterious. I'm glad I listened to it, but it's more of like, you know, if you're familiar with the Firefox books about like survival, it's more about how to survive on an island by, you know, and it's funny because it's like, he had like, Verne's great, but like there was like one or two things in there science wise. Like, I think they knew better than this in the 19th century, but he got this wrong. Like the seasons, you know, he describes the seasons being caused by when the Earth is further away
and its,
you know, orbit and not because of the tilt.
Yeah.
But anyhow, Arthur C. Clarke, Collected Stories, is a guy who does know his science extremely well. He was one of these people, like that golden age of science fiction. Part of what it made it wonderful was these were people who really understood science. They had a very good grasp of it, and they were writing for audiences that loved to read popular mechanics and popular science. There are a lot of people writing science fiction that just, they write science fiction like it's fantasy, but with ray guns and rocket ships, who don't get the science, and that's fine, but that drives me. It's one of the reasons I just don't read much science fiction now, is because I go like, you know, if it's technical, it's pretty boring. You know, when it's not technical, it's just all wrong.
Right.
So, Stryker, it says Clarke invented the telecom. He actually, Clarke was the guy who proposed the geostationary satellite,
Yeah.
You realize that you could have a satellite in a geostationary orbit if you go further enough out that it would have a minor sort of pattern that would keep it relatively over the same spot. So brilliant guy. Brilliant, brilliant guy. And I remember watching Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious Boy. Mysterious World, because he sounded like, right to be a buddy of mine, said, yeah, he sounds like Cancer Boy from Kids in the Hall.
So
there's
the,
a reason why. So
that fine line between the silly and the believable, I think is something that is trod extraordinarily well by Peter F. Hamilton. And
yeah.
It just made me think, wonder whether or not he had another book coming out any minute now. Because his last stuff in the Commonwealth universe is just amazing. Like that last book, how great was that? The one where what's his name made a copy of himself, sent him out to the crazy dreaming void. You haven't finished it?
Couldn't finish the first in the series.
What?
I when they're going around shopping for homes and stuff. You know, like post-singularity, you know, buying a new home kind of sort of thing, kind of just, I'm like...
Man, I wonder if we're talking about the same series. This is the one that came out, I don't know, we'll figure it out later.
Yeah, I love me some Peter F. Hamilton, but man, those are like the latest trilogy, like the first one in there, like, I was like, there's a lot of like the day-to-day and yeah, anyhow, I digress. I love Peter F. Hamilton, let me be clear. But Arthur C. Clarke, those hints of humor, a lot of really pithy, funny stuff in there. A lot of funny stuff. And I think Travel by Wire is a good example of that, which is the first one you'll hear.
Awesome. Awesome. Awesome.
Gentlemen, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.